Does executive privilege mean that the president's employees and cabinet ministers get to break the law and then cover it up by claiming executive privilege? Find out next on Principles and Policies. Hello, I'm your host today, Chuck Michaelis, the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. I'm normally the co-host on this program, but as has been going on for the last week, Barry Sheets is serving as a delegate to the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in America. They're having a meeting in Louisville, Kentucky, so he is excused from the program. And of course, we are both also preparing for Camp American, which starts on this coming Sunday. So we are all very busy. There are a number of things in the news, of course, now that we're all busy and we're short a man, a very important analyst on this team. So I'm stuck doing the analytical work myself. So if it seems a little one-dimensional, that's because my counterpart is not here and he doesn't get to throw in the wisdom that he always brings to this operation. So my apologies to you for that, and there's not much that can be done about it. So you'll have to put up with just my ideas and not mine and Barry's mixed together, and you don't get to pull out the mix that you'd like from that. That being said, let's get right into it today. I said yesterday we were going to explain executive immunity a little more, and really we kind of more or less covered it. What happens is that the President of the United States, if Congress is doing some kind of investigative work about something the executive branch is doing or someone in the executive branch is doing, then very often the President will, to protect himself or very often to protect something that the executive branch is doing, will claim a separation of powers issue, and that is this executive immunity that basically certain documents are not going to be released. It, unfortunately, can be used for good things, for proper things, and it can be used for bad things, improper things. I'm going to give you some examples of in the past when it was used properly. For instance, one of the first times that executive privilege ever got used, George Washington used it. And he used it because the House of Representatives was requesting documents regarding the negotiation of a treaty called the Jay Treaty. And the President of the United States, George Washington, said, no, we're not going to give you that data because this treaty was fully vetted by the Senate. Now, why could he do that? Washington explained that the House of Representatives actually had nothing to do with treaty negotiations. And that is correct. In the powers of Congress, the executive branch has the power to negotiate treaties with the advice and consent of the United States Senate, not of the House of Representatives. Now, why is that? Well, remember that the United States government, when it was first constituted very differently than it is today in terms of its representation scheme. In other words, the House of Representatives represented the people of the given states. Actually, it represented the people of the individual districts. We have to be very careful. We have tended, since the war between the states, we have tended to think of the government as this monolithic entity, and everything that comes out of it is all blended together. The fact is that the congressmen represent the opinion and the constituents of their individual congressional districts, not of the states. In the old days, before 1913, before the amendment that changed the selection of senators from a state privilege to a popular election, the state governments were represented in Congress by the senators. So, in other words, the Senate was appointed by the state legislatures. Now, what did that mean? Well, when you negotiated a treaty in the old days before the Constitution, in the old Articles of Confederation days, the way it worked was there was no chief executive, there was no president. And so the Congress, which was simply delegates appointed by the state governments, would get together and with the consent of enough of the states, they would send delegates out as their representatives to international governments. You can see that's kind of an unwieldy system, which is why the Founding Fathers, when they wrote the Constitution, basically put it in the hands of the chief executive with the advice and the consent of the Senate. Because the Senate served the same purpose as the old Articles of Confederation Congress. They were the representatives of the state governments in the federal government. It's slightly different insofar as you've created a different kind of government, whereas before the United States was really a true confederation, we actually have what's called a federal system wherein there are layers of government. Okay, in this case, I've explained it about as deeply as I can in the short time that we have. George Washington got a subpoena from Congress, and he simply said, we're not going to comply because I don't answer to Congress on this particular issue. I answer to the Senate. And he was correct in that. That was a correct use of executive privilege in that case. He didn't have to answer to Congress. He answered to the Senate on that thing and to the individual voters who had elected him. So that's a good use of it. Now, we have, for instance, Richard Nixon, who attempted to use executive privilege to cover up what some of his people in his employ. I'm not convinced that Richard Nixon knew that the break-in was going to happen. It doesn't matter. It happened under his watch. Nixon's crime was not in so much ordering Watergate, because I don't think that he did, and no, I don't think anybody really thinks that he did. Nixon's crime was in covering up the Watergate break-in and attempting to protect the people who worked in his department in the executive branch as advisory personnel or some kind of underemployees from investigation and prosecution in order to politically save himself. His loyalty to his employees overrode the fact that they had broken the law in service to him, so he attempted to use executive privilege to cover up what he and his advisors were talking about in terms of this illegal break-in. That is Nixon's crime. And, of course, the Supreme Court came out and said, well, you can't do that. Let's look at why. Because in Article 2, it becomes clear, and we have read this on the last few days, and we're going to read it again today. Article 2, Section 4, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of, very important, conviction of, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. In order to convict someone of that, you have to have trial and you have to have an evidence. You have to have evidence to do that. And that's exactly what the hearings are for when the House of Representatives is holding hearings on articles of impeachment. They are gathering evidence. And the thing the president tries to do very often is, rather than coming clean and giving all the information, he attempts to say that these things are very important for quote-unquote national security, because the Supreme Court has held that the president of the United States can protect certain kinds of documents and conversations and those kind of things with his closest advisors that have to do with the maintenance of national security or the safety of the public. And in fact, that's an important consideration. What happens then? Well, let's not kid ourselves that political wrangling does not fit into this situation. There, if the president is of one party and the Congress is of another party, or the Congress is split, one house, one party, one house, another party, and one of them agrees with the president, one of them doesn't agree, you may say this looks like a chaotic situation. No, ladies and gentlemen, this is exactly what the Founding Fathers wanted. They didn't want a rush to judgment. They wanted things to take time. They wanted to have to be, for the congressmen and the senators to be informed. And remember, the Congress indicts the president. They vote the articles of impeachment, but the Senate tries the president. Or other civil officers, judges, cabinet members, those kinds of things. So that's what's going on here. We have a situation where a rush to judgment has been halted. But we also have a situation where a president can claim that something has an effect on national security when maybe it doesn't necessarily do so. We had a situation like that early in the Republic, where Aaron Burr was being tried for treason. Many of you have heard of Aaron Burr. Many of you may not have known that he was Thomas Jefferson's first vice president. Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson came to dislike and distrust one another, despite the fact that they had run as running mates. And it was a little different in that day, because in that day, in the election of 1800, when Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr were first elected, the way it worked was the top vote getter was the president. The second vote getter was the vice president, as long as the president got a majority of the vote of the Electoral College. Very long, detailed information on that. There will be a tape available after Camp American because I'm giving a talk on the Electoral College. You can do a little more research using my talk on that after Camp American and after I get that tape available. But that being said, Aaron Burr in 1807 was being tried for treason for supposedly attempting to possibly break off some of the what we called the Western states at the time, would have been a lot of what came out of the Louisiana Territory. And he also apparently wanted to run a filibuster in New Mexico. That, at least that was the charge. Okay, what happened was Aaron Burr, in his defense, asked a court to issue a subpoena to Jefferson to provide his private letters concerning Burr, because he was under the impression that Thomas Jefferson had had some communications with certain officers of the United States and was possibly attempting to railroad him in these accusations of treason. Chief Justice John Marshall, who really didn't like Jefferson very much, although he was a strong proponent of the powers of the federal government, believe it or not, he and Jefferson were cousins and really had vastly different views of the powers of the United States government. Marshall did a ruling that based on the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, which allows court orders and things for criminal defendants, said the president had no immunity from answering these subpoenas. And Jefferson attempted to claim that the disclosure of the document would imperil the public safety. Marshall said, yeah, not so fast. He said the courts shall be the judge of that, not the executive. And that's where we stand. When the president claims that the documents imperil national security, the arbiter of that is the court system. So now, instead of the executive walling themselves off with this executive privilege, now we have to get the courts involved to take a look at the documents and see whether or not they truly do imperil national security. And that's where we're coming to. I kind of wanted to discuss this today, and we're going to be out of time, so maybe we'll do it on Monday. What we're coming to, what's going on in the White House currently with this claim on Fast and Furious that the president is going to protect national security by claiming that the documents that are being requested by the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee regarding Eric Holder and his involvement in this Fast and Furious gun walking scandal in which guns were run to Mexico under the auspices of the Justice Department, it really does affect national security. Now, does it affect international relations? Oh, you bet it does, because Mexico, understandably, is very angry over the fact that these guns were allowed into Mexico. There was an earlier operation called Operation Wide Receiver. In Operation Wide Receiver, a couple hundred guns were allowed into Mexico. They were traced. They were actually implanted with tracking devices so that they could be traced, and the networks on the way these guns were distributed could be determined by tracking the way these guns traveled with these tracking devices. There doesn't appear to be anything like that in this Operation Fast and Furious. It appears that over 1,600 and maybe as many as 2,000 or more guns were allowed into Mexico, but there doesn't seem to be any method of tracking that they attempted to do. In other words, it looks very much, and I'm hoping to get some confirmation of this from some others, and I'm working on this, it looks very much like the fact is that guns were allowed into Mexico to get the Mexican government to come to the United States government and demand further gun controls. And I have actually seen some press conferences from 2009 that I think we're going to try to run the audio from perhaps on Monday. And that basically says just that. They have a Mexican correspondent who's asking, what are you doing to shut down the gun shops? Well, I think that Operation Fast and Furious was a way of gathering ammunition to do just that, close down the private ownership of and distribution of firearms in the name of international relations. And they were going to attempt to jam through a UN treaty, a gun ban treaty, in order to make that happen. And I think that Fast and Furious blew up in their face and made that impossible. Now, again, unfortunately, we are out of time on today's principles and policies, and we're going to talk about this more, I think, on Monday. Hopefully, Barry and I will be able to get together and do a program while we're at Camp American. If not, we're going to have to run some reruns because sometimes we can get it in a place where the internet connection isn't so good. So, again, join us tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.